My name is Molly.
Kilma.
We are on a plane, a Southwest plane. 5F is where I'm located currently.
Where are you heading?
I am heading to Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
You're a college student currently. What are you studying?
I am going to be certified kindergarten through 12th grade, physical education and health education. And I'm getting my adaptive certification to work with special needs kids in the PE setting.
And how did you decide to study physical education?
I think fitness is the foundation for, like, a lifestyle. I think that remaining healthy, I want to live a long time, but I also want to help impact others to make positive decisions. And I want physical activity to be fun. I had a teacher when I was growing up in elementary school who made it. He told me I was too competitive. And so I want it to be fun. I want kids to enjoy what they're doing and, you know, when they're out of college, be able to pick up things like playing frisbee and playing basketball and swimming and surfing and, you know, to remain healthy and active. And I love kids. But if I could choose, you know, the one thing that I wanted to do would be work with special needs kids or adaptive students, depending on politically correctness.
Okay, we're going to get into that part in a bit, but I also want to talk with you about this. You said that you're an athlete yourself and you play
Yes.
basketball. Tell me what led you to do that.
I think just being given the gifts as I was tall. I always had a passionate drive for being physically active. I loved to run around. I was totally the tomboy, like beating up the boys at recess and just being competitive. And so when I figured out that that's what I was good at, I wanted to use that. I wanted to utilize that as, you know, something that would like have a positive impact in my life. I saw great success as being an athlete.
And you played basketball for how many years?
I have been playing basketball since I was in fifth grade, but then when I was a junior in high school, that's when I tore my ACL. I would consider myself, after that, still playing for, you know, 3 years of college basketball, but never fully a season, just practices, preseason, postseason, did a lot of physical therapy, but yeah, it was definitely who I was and identity as an athlete.
And you shared with me something very important, that injuring your ACL actually taught you what you described as one of the most important lessons in life. Tell me more about that.
Well, I feel that one of the most important things that you can take away in your life is going through experiences and trying to come out with it with a positive outlook on it. I think that everything happens for a reason, and you know, the saying "it is what it is" totally applies, I think, not only for my life, but other individuals' lives, because you will go through ups and downs, and you have to take those, you know, downs and spin them in a way that are beneficial, you know? I just feel like there are a lot of things that I wouldn't have experienced or had the opportunity to be a part of if I hadn't gone through the identity crisis as not being an athlete anymore, and so I've had to find out the other things that I'm made up of. So it's taking things that happen to you and putting them in a light where, you know, could be worse.
So talk me through how you injured your ACL and like the kind of the specific details of how that experience impacted you or took you away from basketball.
Well, I had been playing and involved in athletics since I was in fifth grade. I had been playing, and it was a Tuesday night summer league game. And I don't remember who we were playing. It was like Maguanago High School, someone's like JV team. So it was really a game that I didn't necessarily need to be playing in. Because we were playing like a lower skilled team. But then I totally remember going down, you know, down to the low key on the court, planting my knee and just pop and twist. And like since then, it's definitely been it's been an experience where I feel like now I can look at anything and I can do it. You know, I think through trial and error, it's something that you have to carry on. You can't reminisce and stay on negative experiences, because I feel like that's just going to further drive you into that hole. So it changed my life as a person, an individual, because I had to find out what else I was passionate about, what other qualities and things that I could bring to the table for, you know, relationships, friendships, as a family member, just as a community individual.
And what else did you find when you were looking for answers to what you could bring to the table in all those different arenas?
Well, first off, it was a very frustrating experience to go through, because that's all I knew. I only knew how to be an athlete. And when you're a female, it definitely puts you in your own category, because it's, you know, typically like a male-dominated thing is sports. And so after that I found out like it was okay to be friends with kids in, you know, the different social groups, and it was okay to do things that weren't just sports. You know, I started to pick up learning how to play the guitar, and I feel like it allowed me to let myself out of a shell, because I was so focused on just being predominantly a female high school athlete. I mean, an even college athlete, that I was able to meet new people and step outside the boundary of something that I was not familiar with. And it was scary. Oh my gosh, it was very scary at first. But after getting through that point, now I feel like I can do anything, go anywhere, talk to anyone. And it's a positive experience regardless of what happens.
Had you not injured your ACL, how would your life be different today?
I think it would be very different. I think that I would be the same person that I was. I don't think it would have allowed myself the space and experiences that I need to grow as an individual. I think I would have been strictly an athlete. I would have hung out with only the other athletes. I wouldn't have been able to meet, you know, people in different social groups. And to me, that's huge. I've always been one who, you know, enjoys the presence of people who bring something else to the table other than me. I think that keeps life interesting, because if we were all the same, obviously things would be really boring. But I think it's also helped me. That's the biggest perk of working with kids with disabilities, is because it's almost like having that feeling of something that being taken away to you, but on a way smaller scale than what these kids have to go through on a daily basis. And so that's really helped me. It's like I have my own little special place in my heart for these kids, because there are things that they can't do, and I can totally, you know, feel with them and be on the same, you know, similar category with that.
So do you feel in a way that you injuring your ACL is ultimately what led you to this particular path of working with special needs children?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's a bittersweet happening. It's devastated me as an athlete, because I had all these goals and all these plans, but now I've also learned that throughout life you can just roll with things. You can take them as they come and just let life happen. I know that there are some things that are in your control and there are some things that aren't, and you just have to take what is in your control, you know, and do the best you can with it. And there will be things that fail when you don't want them to, but I feel like that's life. You go through different experiences and it'll help shape you to be who you are. I know I would not be the same person I am right now that I would have been if I didn't go through that.
So, and one of the things that you identify as is an athlete. It's still part of your identity, and it probably always will be.
Yes.
So I have to ask you, knowing what you know now, so you're an athlete, but you've been kind of taken out of the forefront of your sport in a way because of an injury. So what advice would you have to other athletes who are in the court right now, as well as just people in general in your generation and beyond?
I feel athletics, especially in women, is getting much more popular, but I also feel that with students and children, we are getting to a point where being an athlete is becoming such a priority, almost an unrealistic priority. We have young kids who are in, you know, second and third grade, and they're going to soccer practice every day for 2 hours, and, you know, these kids aren't given the opportunity to grow up and be quote-unquote normal kids. And, you know, we're forcing this hope, this unrealistic dream of that you are going to get a scholarship, you're going to go play in the WNBA, or you're going to play, you know, the professional soccer. And I think being well-rounded and, you know, getting to experience all the best of all worlds, you know, if that be like involved in music, if that be involved in athletics, if that be involved in some sort of club or extracurricular activity that you involve doing, I don't think that you should write off one over the other because of, you know, you're good at one. I wish I would have, you know, if I could go back now, I would have loved to be involved in music or something that definitely would have allowed me to, you know, to learn and grow and shape myself as an individual. Because when you get out into the real world and you're done with high school and you're going into college and you're out of college, you don't take your textbooks with you. You know, you have to take what your experiences and kind of use them to the best of your ability and roll with what you're doing. But I definitely, biggest recommendation would only be to experience more than just one thing, because I think that sometimes people don't know what their, you know, other hidden talents or what else they're passionate about until they're given the opportunity or they're forced to have to find it.
Who would you say has been your biggest mentor along the way that's really helped you become the person who you are, other than yourself? You seem like you've definitely got a lot of strength just within you, but is there anybody else that played a role?
I think the biggest supporter of who I have become and really shaped me to be who I was probably my high school basketball coach, who saw me go through these ups and lows, ups and downs, highs and lows, in regards to being just an athlete and then going from athlete to not athlete. And he watched me develop as a person over these last, 6 years of being, a happy person and a sad person and a disappointed person, but also, seeing that I am more than just an athlete and a basketball player, and that I bring more to the table than that. And so getting that, that assurance and that positive enforcement, I feel has allowed me to crack open the shell and try new things and be okay with trying new things and knowing that, it could be scary and it could be, something that you don't necessarily anticipate, but it's still worth a try.
And if you had to distill all of your life experience up until the ripe age of 22 that you're at right now, and think about one most important lesson that you've learned along the way, what would that be?
I think that would be to just let life happen. I think that so often we get caught up in, where we're going and what we're supposed to be doing, that we, forget to take a step back and look at, what really makes you truly happy and passionate. And I feel like you really have to let things pan out how they're supposed to. And sometimes things will, they will roll your way or they won't, and you have to take that for what it is and move on with it. I think a lot of times as a society we stay focused on the negativity and whatever, but I feel like change is just, it's always going to be happening. It's a continuous cycle, and so something else will come about that is positive and will, erase the other things that have happened.
And I have to ask this, because you've talked about it a little bit, but I'm wondering, is there sort of a concrete experience along your way that made you think, okay, I'm going to make the best of my situation, and the thing I'm meant to do is to work with special needs children? Is there any kind of concrete experience or person or something that really inspired you or helped you connect the dots?
I think the biggest thing was just, the continual disappointments and, trying to get your continual disappointments, and then also just taking that and moving on and prospering with it, and then getting involved in one of the classes through the school that I'm going to at Carroll. They give you the opportunity to get your adaptive certification, and I never really had thought, even contemplated having that as one of my certifications and doing something like that. But once I got into the classroom and started working with those kids, I fell in love with them and found this hidden passion and desire to help these kids make the best of what they have and just experience life and try to get the most that they can out of it.
The last question is the rhythm of change. What does that mean to you, and how does that apply to your life?
I think the rhythm of change is something that is continually and constantly happening all the time. And I think for different people, it can mean different things. But I also think, as a whole, it means that, to embrace the change. That's one of the biggest things that I've come comfortable with, and I feel most comfortable with change, which is weird because with some people, they fear change and they fear the uncomfortability of, going from one thing that they know all the time to something that's completely new. And I think that it's something that, can be great when looked at it in a positive point of view.
And for your own life, that's applied because?
The rhythm of change for me would be looking into the future and not being afraid of the new things and the changes that will be coming up into my life, and just taking it for what it's worth and rolling with it. And everything has its place and time, and sometimes, you don't understand it and you just have to roll with it.
Beautiful. And then what's your hometown that you live in?
I live right now in Stone Bank, Wisconsin.
And is that also your hometown?
Correct.
And you are 22?
Yes, I am.
Anything else you want to add?
No, this has just been a great experience and a wonderful plane ride. I got so lucky to sit with these two.
Cheers.
My name is Jill Sullivan, and I'm a professor at Arizona State University. And I'm on Southwest Airlines. And I happen to, just by serendipity, end up in a row with two fantastic young women. We're all three. Our lives are in three decades. A woman in her 20s, a woman in her 30s, and I'm in my 40s. And we have an unbelievable connection and a lot of shared experiences over three different decades. And it's so exciting. And it's so amazing that these multiple generations of women have so many similarities in their lived experiences. And it's just really remarkable, and it's been really fulfilling for me.
What are some of the most important things that you've thought about, or what's been the most rewarding about this plane ride so far?
First of all, that maybe age really isn't that big of a deal between women and goals and what they want to do. It's interesting, even though with those decades, I'm seeing shared experiences of motivation, independence, of dating even, or sort of life stories across all these goals, aspirations. It's just fun to hear and see. I thought to myself, sitting next to these two young ladies, that the future of womanhood is safe. I actually thought that with these two remarkable young women I'm sitting next to.
So earlier you had an interesting observation as I was interviewing this woman over here. Somebody asked us to be quiet. You had a really interesting observation about that. Would you talk about it?
Yeah, I was watching the journalist in her 30s interview a 20-year-old about her experiences. And while I was enthralled and really respected that and really enjoyed her life experiences and her wisdom, a man probably in his 60s turned around and asked them to be quiet. They were being too noisy. And when there's so much airplane noise, I really can't believe that they're being too noisy. And there might be a little bit of jealousy or something generationally about powerful women, especially powerful young women, being silenced. And it was very much a metaphor for silencing women, capable women. And I'm actually kind of glad he did it, because it's not uncommon, especially for the generation of that man. We're in his generation, not necessarily post-feminist generation, but certainly his generation, to silence women. And he silenced these young women, and it was kind of a neat experience just to see that happening.
And your story is really intriguing. You are from a family that has two children that didn't finish high school, and you went on all the way to get your PhD in music. Talk to me a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, I always thought that sort of music education saved my life, because my sister actually had an unplanned pregnancy at a very young age, 16. My brother was just really kind of a workaholic, but he was always caught up in drugs a little bit too, and we're a very white middle class family, so it's not what you expect, I think. And so that both of those experiences for my brother and sister side railed them. And although they're very successful today, I lived through that and my parents' disappointments with them, so I never want to disappoint my parents. And all my friends in music classes, and it was the music classes and the society built in the music classes that really built my self-esteem to go on to college. And I was the first person in my family really to go to a four-year institution. But it wasn't because of my math classes or my science classes. It was the music classes that built my self-esteem. And because my friends in the music classes were all going to college, so what else are you going to do? You're going to go to college.
So talk me back all the way to the time that you were in band playing the clarinet, and you said, I just ended up to be good at it. You're very humble about it. But talk me through that. What was it about the clarinet and the experience of playing it that made you think, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, my parents are very supportive financially, and I always had private lessons. And that put me past the rest of the kids, and I was very successful. And I would win competitions, and so it made me think, this is something I'm good at. And so, maybe I should stick with something I'm good at. And so I just decided, plus I always liked kids and I liked people, thought maybe I want to be a teacher. And I always thought from the age of like 5 or 6 I wanted to be a teacher. I have no idea why. And then so the combination of music was something I love. And that sort of dream of working with people, music teaching. Oh, okay, I'm good at that. That's what I want to do. So that's what I am.
And what has music taught you about life in general? And how has it really led you to where you're at today?
Well, music is definitely, people forget. People think it makes you smarter. We don't have any definitive research on that. It's all correlational research. But I think it's the sociological aspect of the community building when you're in an ensemble that really makes you feel like part of a family, and it just inspires you. So I think that's what was the motivating factor for me, the love of family, that just love of being with the people and doing it all together. That was really fun.
And I have to ask you about this. I always err on the side of asking and giving the other person the opportunity not to answer. But you have a very intriguing relationship story about your recent marriage. Would you mind sharing that?
Sure. When I was in high school, I went to prom with a young man who was also in band. We were both kind of jocks in high school, too. I was on my high school tennis team, and he was on the cross-country team. But he played in the band. He was a brass player, and I played clarinet. We ended up going to prom. We ended up going to the same college. We broke up after the first year because we both just were too young to be in a serious relationship. 25th class reunion comes up. He sends me an email. 2 years later, I respond, and we end up meeting and feeling like no time has passed. And so we end up deciding that we're going to get married. So your first love, you never know what's going to happen.
And you're in a very long-distance relationship. Tell me about that.
Even though we felt we were really in love, but I teach at Arizona State University, and he's a officer in the Navy, so he's in Chicago, and I live in Tempe, Arizona, and we rely on technology to keep us connected, cell phones, texting, and of course, Skyping, and then we see each other at least once a month in person.
And you talked to me, you said something that I think is really important both for women and men to think about, which was that you think it took him a long time to have enough self-esteem to ask you out. Why do you think it's important for people to have a very good self-concept?
Well, I think that when you feel like you've arrived or you've accomplished something and you're proud of yourself, it boosts your self-worth. And I think he'd arrived at a place in his life where people in his workplace as an officer were showing him a lot of respect on a daily basis. So I think that just boosted his self-esteem and maybe... Or maybe he was just lonely, I don't know. He decided to, he was maybe at a point in his life that I might accept him as being worthy. I'm not sure, that's one of my theories, I guess.
I love it. Just side note, I fly all the time and I'm afraid of turbulence, so it's so fun that we're just chatting away and we're going to forget about the very turbulent ride we're having right now. But what have you learned about yourself from this relationship?
Well, it's interesting that really if your impressions as a young kid, because we were young, 17 and 19 years old, might be pretty smart, might be pretty intuitive. Often we don't give teenagers enough credit. And I think we can learn so much from young people. And we both felt, Steve and I, my husband and I, when we saw each other 27 years later for dinner, that we were so, that we felt the same about each other, and that those feelings we had all those years previously, we still have the same connection or vibe or something. And things don't necessarily change in how you feel just because you've grown as an academic or success in your, you know, so perhaps sometimes those first impressions as a kid are pretty wise.
If you had to think about the most important lesson that you've learned on your life journey so far, what would that be and how did you learn it?
Okay. It's a life lesson because it's a personal struggle for me, and that is about temper. And I don't know if it's because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy from a young age. Everybody said to my parents, because I'm the only redhead in the family, oh, she's a redhead, she's going to have a temper. Always people said that to me from age 3 on, probably 5. And so I'm not sure if it's a chicken and egg, you know, why that happened, but I have a temper. And so I've had to learn as a professional over the last 20 years how to control that temper. because I got away with it a lot as a kid with my parents. So I have this life rule that it's a 72-hour rule. Wait 3 days before you respond to somebody who upsets you, or an upsetting email, or just a situation. If you're a person that has a temper and you might say the wrong thing, it's sort of a way to keep you from biting your tongue. And usually after 3 days, it's not upsetting anymore. And so you've saved yourself some embarrassment professionally or from responding in a bad way.
And there's plenty of people who have tempers who never check them. And so I'm wondering what life experience made you decide, like, I'm going to check this, or I'm going to develop a system for this?
I think it's because I aspired to be a leader. And you can't be a leader and behave like that. And I think I was motivated not to be necessarily more polite to people, but my own wanting to be a good person in a leadership role. And you can't lead with having that kind of a temper. So that was my motivation. Like, I better figure this out pretty quick, or people aren't going to like me, and I'm not going to be able to, they're not going to respect my other contributions.
And was there one kind of concrete experience where maybe you lost your temper that you really was like, oh, and you had some time to debrief and think about it?
I know exactly when. I was a student at the University of Michigan, and I got mad at a professor, and I walked out and slammed the door. And he was a very respected professor that all the students idolized, including myself. But something had happened, and I was mad. I was 21, 22. And he called me back in. He was so patient with me. And he said something, he gave me a lecture, and he said, 20 years ago, I would have slapped you verbally for everything you did to me. He said, but now, he said, I know better, and this is going to be a teaching moment for you. And he was so patient of him. And I respected him so much to give me that second chance. That was the first time, and I remember it, I can answer that question so fast, that I figured out, hey, I better figure this out. He's the first one to care enough about me to, you know, give me that lesson. And that was really the moment I started on this journey to try to rein myself in.
So it was really a lesson on tough love, because I've definitely encountered teachers who've had, or professors even, who've had a student who had a temper or was very short with them or hard on the outside, even though they're maybe soft on the inside, who just leave it. But for you, the tough love approach really was worth it?
Totally worth it, because we all respected him so much, and I deserved it, and he was so patient. He could have slapped me verbally, and if he would have, I would have been crushed, because I really respected him so much. And so that was another teaching lesson that was so valuable from a teacher who cared and was smart enough to know how to handle it.
I remember my other question as well. Did this lesson, how has this shift in, like, watching the way that your temper works, how has it affected your relationships, romantic relationships? Well, you have a husband and friendships and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's affected most primarily by professional relationships. And I think I just know to wait and stop and think a little bit, because I know how much that temper's got me in trouble in the past. So now I just leave the room, or, you know, you just learn to rein it in. But it's not really any easier. It's not any easier.
So what are some things that you've done to rein it in, even though it's a struggle?
I usually try to distract myself, and I go do something. I call somebody to go do something. I just try to get out of that mindset. I try not to be alone, because sometimes if I'm alone, it stews more. And so if I can call a friend, I can Skype with somebody, I call my parents or somebody, and just totally forget about it.
So you don't call them and vent. You're talking about something completely different.
Sometimes I call and vent, but sometimes it's completely different. Sometimes I just go to the gym. And I just try to exercise it off or something like that. But, yeah. But sometimes I don't call necessarily to vent. I call to check my own self. It's like I trust my parents to check if I'm being unreasonable. And usually I find out I am. And so that helps me, again, wait and figure out how I'm going to answer this. I have to tell you, though, I have friends that are very patient with me and have helped me through this process, too. And colleagues who have been very patient to tell me their kind of strategies for what they do. And then often they find that they have to wait too.
And, oh, I remember another question I wanted to ask. You said early in the interview that you think that this intergenerational row, 20s, 30s, 40s, really proves that womanhood is going to live forever. Why do you think that's important?
Why do I think it's important? Because I think the gains that women had made from suffrage till now have been so important. And sometimes women my age and even older of the 1960s and 70s think that young women in their 20s and 30s don't have a clue what they went through to get equal rights amendment. And they're afraid that and I hear it voiced by them, by Gloria Steinem, who I've met. Ted Turner's wife, used to be Jane Fonda. I've met them, and they express concern. Maybe the younger generation doesn't understand that there still needs to be improvements. And so when I hear these two smart young women talk, I think, okay, they totally get it. And so they understand the history of women and women's rights and independence and the value of that. So it just makes me happy. I think, wow, we're in good hands. So and smart, these young women.
And has there ever been a time that you have felt silenced?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm in a field of instrumental music, and it's a field that's all men. My first job, I worked with 9 other instrumental teachers, and I was the first female instrumental teacher in that school district. And I was often silenced in my opinions, yet I still today believe I was the best musician in the group. But because I was young and because I was female, I often, my opinions and thoughts were not taken seriously.
So. And how did you get through that?
I had a lot of good female friends. I had a principal. She was fantastic. And I could go to her. She was a great leader. She had her doctorate. She was smart. And she helped me through it. And then I quit my job, eventually got my doctorate, and I started writing about that. So, and just became, wanted to make sure in the future women in that field weren't silenced.
Only 2 questions left. What advice would you offer other women of any generation based on what you've learned up until today?
Man, it's so important to be true to yourself. I think that don't rely on men. This may not be something you want to hear, but I really feel like that. You need to get educated. You need to get your own job. And when you have that feeling of independence, you're less likely to be in hurtful relationships, relationships where people aren't treating you right because you know you can exit and still support yourself. And I think, I don't know, maybe that's a cop-out or something. I don't know, but I think that's critical. Support yourself. Believe in yourself. You'll feel more confident if you have your own job. And then you can make decisions. You don't have to stay in because of money, you know, which I think a ton of women do. Be able to get out on your own.
And finally, you like this one because you're a musician. What does the rhythm of change mean to you, and how does it apply to your life?
The rhythm of change for me was, I guess right now I think I'm thinking of it because I was recently remarried. The rhythm of change is being, again, confident in yourself to exit a former relationship. To me, it's kind of about relationships right now. And feeling strong, feeling like you don't have to settle for that man if you're happy, and go for the, you know, making sure you're in a relationship that really makes you happy, and going for that, and don't settle for anything less.
And now I have to lie and ask you another question because you've inspired me with your answer. You talked earlier about just being very, like when you reached a particular age, feeling like, okay, I need to get married because this is what I have to do. This is what women are expected to do. And is that what led you into your first relationship?
Yeah, I felt peer pressure. All my friends were getting married and they had all these cool weddings. And I just felt like I was kind of alone at 26. You know, you're not with your parents anymore. And I felt like I needed that unit or something, that social unit, and I wanted to be a part of that. And everybody else was doing it, so maybe there's something about that. And I did it, and it turned out to be a big mistake for me.
And how did you get to that point where you realized it wasn't right for you and then had the courage to leave?
Well, it's always been this problem because I'm a very driven person, and the person I married wasn't driven at all. So our personalities were pretty opposite, and I was working 3 jobs, and he was only part-time college student, wasn't doing anything. And I think that frustration of me working three jobs and him sitting around not doing much, that just infuriated me and tore us apart, I think. And I knew I just had bigger goals and bigger dreams to be in a relationship with someone who wasn't on a big career path or had goals like I did. I couldn't settle for a spouse that didn't aspire to be something. But that's just me, you know.
And anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I don't think so. I think young women probably have it figured out better than I did, or my generation of women did nowadays with relationships. I'm just happy to see that there's such wonderful, strong, smart women coming up, and I think everything's in good hands, and those feminists and pre-feminists don't have to worry too much about the future. I grew up in the Midwest in a very small town, about 2,000 people.
What was it called?
It was called Geneseo, and it's in Illinois, right in smack dab in the middle of farm country, and people even say today that it's the town that, you know, it hasn't passed through any time. It's still like early 19th century, you know, or late 19th century in their values. And I currently now live in Tempe, Arizona.
Thank you very much.